Warning. This story includes materials that are classified your ears only due to disturbing content. Other times we are quite silly and really just a hoot. Unless you are cleared for graphic depictions of sex, violence, or dirty words, this never happened. We were never here. It should go without saying that this is not intended for kids, but we're still saying it for their sake and for yours. We don't always play nice. You've been warned.
The hostile personality. Manifestation of the subject's repressed urges. We use a special property of the fissure beneath Blue City called the Lacuna to erase these urges and...
You deserved it.
Everyone is briefed before our mission.
Let's say, hypothetically, you had orders to do something you think is incredibly dangerous and stupid.
But you forgot most of it.
Static. That's about all we know.
You sound lost, Agent. Strange events, meetings with specific personalities and the like are referred to as escalations.
Yes, it's bad.
Like a chess game.
Static is bad. That's what static is.
Unfortunately, we're not sure what the pieces do or how to play in any meaningful capacity.
Badness.
Things can get out of hand fast.
I will make your life intolerably painful.
The conflict. Some kind of ongoing war.
Blue City is beautiful.
Embedded spies.
In the way noir films and dusty cathedrals are beautiful.
A series of bombings.
Even the most colorful things are drab and pasty.
It stays that way.
The sky above.
Passers-by are dressed formally in styles decades behind the time.
Citizens avoid talking about the Spider-Man.
Even the cutting edge of fashion here comprises old suits and dresses.
Once they're on you, there's no shaking them.
Haven't been seen since 1985.
Either you dispatch of the HP or you eject before you end up dead.
A corner cafe with parasol-covered wooden tables and wide clear windows. A scratchy record of previously unheard Chet Baker songs plays low in the background. The occasional clink and clatter of various dishware-silverware interactions over a steady stream of conversation creates the perfect ambiance. Mixing now with that all-pervading vanilla almond smell is that of espresso, yeasty croissants, and exotic perfumes. As Seals arrives from the city streets, he mutters to whatever other agents are coming along. Anyone else notice that smell isn't going away no matter where we go? As Tucker enters the cafe, something clicks in his mind. He walks up to the counter and orders a cup of coffee, and the first vaguely appetizing thing he sees, and tries to strike up a conversation with the clerk as he processes the order. And don't poison it either, he laughs. I read in the paper about this person who goes around poisoning total strangers with cyanide. Obviously, I'm not afraid of that, otherwise I wouldn't be here, but isn't that crazy? I mean, I'm not a people person myself, but that's taking it a bit far. And cyanide? Who uses that? I thought it was only a plot device for trashy detective novels. Tucker and Seals have walked into a cafe with a few filled tables, maybe 10 people at most. The completely nondescript young woman behind the counter quietly takes Tucker's order, tilting her head quizzically in response to Tucker's conversation topic. In unison, the patrons stop conversing. A quick review of the room's personality content reveals that everyone is eating or drinking something. Their actions are perfectly normal and human individually, but as a synchronous unit, the effect is unnerving. As Barker approaches the cafe, there is another click on the silver device as the cafe's combined patronage begin to eat and drink. The force of the tiny black hand is immense yet contained, great pressure acting upon the hidden gears of the thing as it shifts to the second interval. Barker furrows his brow at the watch-like apparatus as it ticks forward. Skill strolls through the establishment, glancing at Tucker now and then as if he's just a regular guy waiting for the dude at the counter to shut up and get out of the way so he can put in his own order. Pretending to be looking out the windows while he strolls and waits, he's actually looking to see if there's a phone anywhere nearby, just in case they need one. Across the street from the cafe stands a scratched and dingy phone booth, hard to tell if it was there before Seals started looking. Seals continues his leisurely recon of the area, looking for floral arrangements, particularly any unique ones that would be on occupied tables. No flowers. Cafe is rather simple and undecorated, though still appealing to the eye, inducing a relaxed, cool feeling in the viewer. Nobody here matches the description of the hostile personality. Barker saunters in, tipping his hat to any personalities that happen to glance his way. He keeps his sunglasses on. Barker lets Tucker and Seal see to the counter while he makes his way to the other end of the establishment and sits in an empty booth, getting a good look at the area, keeping an eye out for anything notable or otherwise out of place. It might be the distance or the people moving in and out of their field of vision, but if Tucker and Seals care to look, Barker seems to be pulling something from his jacket and opening it up. He glances down at the table he's sitting at now and then, making sure to keep it out of sight. Pages within the clean, crisp manila folder are as unreadable as any other text in Blue City. Whatever it previously compelled Barker to read is not affecting him right now. Included photographs, however, depict a round-faced woman smiling from behind a hospital nurse's station. Another photo shows her in the arms of a rather slimy-looking man, she with her freckly, dimpled face, floating serenely over the strapless red dress, and he in a stained dress shirt. Thinning hair stretched over a balding head with ample gel. The final photo is a dead body rotting in a bathtub, graphic enough to make one retch. There is no restroom here, and aside from the front entrance, the only other door is labeled private, accessible only by going around one of the two open ends of the counter. Barker is seen reaching into his jacket again before either of the other agents sit at his table. Tucker takes his food back to the table where Barker sits, looking defeated. He motions Seals over. I intend on making a call. You have anything more important? Seals walks over to the agent's table and sits down, looking a bit disappointed. Can't find anything useful here except that phone across the street, he says, quietly, twiddling his thumbs absently. And nope, it's all yours. His eyes drift towards Barker's furtive movements, and he raises his head in a small upward nod, asking, what's the deal with that thing? Barker pulls out his watch and lays it on the table by the time either of them arrive, tapping the cover again. Not sure. It seems to be stuck at 2, whatever that is. It clearly doesn't read or tell time. It must have some other purpose. He glances around again, leaning to try and look through one of the doors in the back, or maybe a window in them. Hmm, Seal says, leaning forward a little to look at the device as he rubs his jaw contemplatively. Maybe a compass of some kind? Still wouldn't make much sense if it's stuck when you move around, unless the little symbols change while you move rather than the hand. Tucker guesses. Maybe it's an escalation meter, not that that's at all informative. Barker looks at the cafe's patrons, then the watch again. This makes no sense. He's clearly monitoring something, but I've no idea what. There's nothing here anyway, he says, getting up from the table, pocketing the watch. Make your phone call if you're gonna. I'm gonna try and get something done. We're getting nowhere. Tucker goes outside and picks up the phone and jabs at one of the buttons with his index finger. Control. I know we probably already know this, but the drugs have really fucked us. What is escalation and its causes? Control responds.
Certain behaviors, actions, and key phrases act as triggers for static. These are your escalations, and to trigger static is to escalate. Such triggers are usually tied to the subject's vector, which is vaguely related to their psychological profile. Sometimes even asking questions about the subject can cause escalations, though those triggers are typically more abstract and counterintuitive than that. As static increases, the environment of Blue City changes, often in ways related to the hostile personality's vector.
Although intermediate amounts of static are often needed to complete a mission's primary or secondary objectives, excessive static may result in... The company remains unsure whether static is happening in Blue City, or the subject's mind in the causal fashion that it seems, or if escalations pull agents into the static that already exists there. You're not yet cleared to learn anything else about the varying levels of static, how it affects senior agents, or... text omitted.
Tugger hangs up the phone and punches the panel of the booth twice before heading back to the group, dropping his voice so only the table's inhabitants can hear. Damn it, that was worthless. Can't count on control for anything. Okay, guys, look. I know I've got seniority on two of you. I may have seized the initiative on the last mission, but I don't have shit at the moment. Our objectives are threefold right now. Escalate the static, profile the HP, and you know what the HP. Tucker looks down at his coffee and tries to smell it, but only ends up with another whiff of almonds and vanilla. Letting Chaffer do his own thing was a mistake. I have no doubts about his competence. It's the rest of us I'm worried about. Maybe we'd be better off supporting him. The man gets results. But he's not here, so let's go back over what we know. Control said the HP was here. This is clearly not the case. Chaffer guessed the possibility of the hospital or the pharmacy. Given that Chaffer is the golden touch today, I suggest those are our priorities. We have also noticed that everyone is eating and everything smells like cyanide. The HP also likes flowers, although none of this is actionable. In light of the situation, I suggest... Barker walks towards the counter and brushes through the open end. Tucker cuts off abruptly as Barker decides to barge into the private room. The fuck you going? He calls after him as he rushes to catch up. Seals hesitates, very apprehensive about going in there at first. Guys, he says in a half whisper, then gets up and hurries over, catching up just as Barker makes it to the door. Any idea what you're doing, Barker? Look, if anyone asks, say we're health inspectors, he says, glancing tensely over his shoulder at the rest of the cafe. Walking into the cafe, Shield sees the others heading towards the back. Unaware of what they might have discovered, he follows them, trying to look official. Barker notices a third click as he approaches the door. A young woman in thick bottleneck glasses ducks her head underneath her table to retch. One of the servers behind the counter leans against a wall, fanning herself, face flush and sweaty. Noticing the distress from the patron and server, Seal stops following Barker and walks over to the server with a concerned look on his face. You alright? He asks her, frowning as he briefly glances over at the person who's throwing up. Furrowing his brow, he draws in a deep breath to see whether that almond vanilla smell has gotten any stronger. Seals finds that the smell is ubiquitous, yet sourceless. The woman holds out a hand as if to say she'll be fine, but says nothing, gagging as she attempts to communicate. Barker is apparently the only one able to get through the door. Seals nods a little at the woman and goes back over to Tucker with a deeply concerned look. He leans in and speaks very quietly. Do you think it's possible that this entire world, city, whatever it is being poisoned? I mean, the HP is said to be a poisoner and we can all smell cyanide in the air. See that woman over there throwing up? Maybe there's something in her food. Just a theory, but this is getting weird and I think we're running out of time fast. Barker's watch ticks over to the fourth interval. There's a small plop at the top of the building. A moment later, a dead squirrel rolls off of the roof, deflecting off a parasol before landing dead in front of the cafe entrance, tiny black eyes staring into the building. Tucker quietly replies, I think that poison is everywhere, or the idea of poison, which is poisonous but not quite the same. But if things are getting weirder, it means we're getting closer, I think. A long white Chevrolet National Ambulance circa 1950 glides smoothly by the cafe, on its way to acquire some unfortunate personality. Tucker follows Barker into the back with reborn purpose in his stride. Seals tries to follow Tucker, not so sure the door is going to let him through for some reason. Seals gets a hold of himself and manages to cross the threshold, if that be his wish. Shields pushes through the door into the back as well.
The gate to the Heights is open, possibly since the agents last visited some time ago. That almond vanilla smell is everywhere, unshakable. The surrounding homes are as lavishly ominous as ever. The house seems to be in good repair. Someone did wonders with the landscaping. The gate bearing the large, ornate D is wide open. The avuncular Giles Corey drifts through the gate and heads towards the well-appointed manor house. A large, imposing double door with black iron hinges dominates the front of the mansion. He gently knocks on the front door and folds his fleshy hands behind his back. As he waits, he taps his foot to a Chopin waltz that's been echoing through his head since he, Chaffer, entered the Blue City. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. I should have requisitioned a sidearm, he thinks, feeling a slight twinge of apprehension, his gravelly Cockney accent rearing its head. With an ominous creak, the door swings wide open. Within, the foyer is large, with a high buttressed ceiling. The house is sparsely decorated, many items unshelved and out of place, the walls freshly replastered, and the floors covered in bits of detritus from the repairs and improvements made since the robbery. Cassandra's grinning face pops out from behind the door. Hiya, she says, giggling. Javier's mixing our drinks in the sunroom. She holds out a hand. Care to join us, or would you like a tour first? A siren wails in the distance. Corey's jowls swell into a smile. A tour of this lovely estate would be much appreciated. He removes his hat, revealing a bald pate, and steps into the foyer and keeps his eyes firmly fixed on his host. I was hoping you'd ask, Cassandra says, yelling over her shoulder in a shrill voice. Javi, I'm going to take him on the tour. A distant voice replies, fine, fine, dismissively from an unseen room. Cassandra grabs Corey's hand, pulling him along with her like a wind-crazed balloon dragging a zeppelin. I'm sorry it's such a mess, Mr. Corey. That robber took everything that wasn't nailed down, even a few things that were. For the most part, the tour is rather bland. Much of the house is in mid-repair, but even without the entirety of its treasures, the home yields many oddities. Statues, idols, and relics from various world cultures, modern and ancient, dot the home. The few which Giles' inner Chaffer recognizes are death gods, depraved creatures, and depictions of hellish scenes. Weapons, medieval torture devices, and the like fill every available nook and shelf. And my favorite, the bedroom, she says, shaking her hips suggestively as she throws open a set of pearly white double doors. The master bedroom is dominated by a huge silk-canopied bed and finely carved wooden furniture. There's a sickly sweet smell here, something altogether different from the vanilla almond cyanide that otherwise dominates Blue City. Cassandra disappears into the master bedroom. Close the doors, would you? She says, giggling. Corey steps into the room but leaves the door opened and furtively searches out the sweet, nauseating aroma. The smell emanates from the walk-in closet, putrefaction cut with potpourri. The door is shut, the room within dark, but this is definitely the source of the smell. A shadow falls over Corey. What you looking at? Says Cassandra in an I've got a secret tone. A surprisingly toned body, typically hidden under frumpier clothes and flapper dresses, is almost fully revealed in her black negligee. She wears her hair about her shoulders. Her lavender lacquer fingernail runs over the large of his back. Don't you want to finish the tour? The pearl doors pull shut, seemingly of their own volition. Actually, I'd love to play a little game with you, says Giles. But the sort of games I play require blindfolds and more than two people. Any chance we could invite Hermietta over to play with us, too? He bats his eyes grotesquely and plants his large posterior on the bed. He flicks his eyes at the closet and says, what about hubby? Is he going to mix drinks all night, or can we make him watch? Cassandra claps her hands excitedly. Oh, a game! How I love games! Mr. Corey, you are quite desperate to get your hands on this Hermietta Stahl. A protege, in your words. Perhaps you meant to say, darling paramour? She stalks across the room like a large cat sizing up its prey. Tell me, fat boy, if we got you this girl, what could you do for us?
Anything, says Corey, eyes glittering.
His tongue slithers across his lips like a worm.
Do you remember the visitors in black suits, Mr. Corey? We couldn't help but notice you've got rapport with them. The story goes they're looking for the same person you are, she says. Javi and I are dying to learn about those little buttons they carry. A few weeks ago, we caught two of them snooping around the house. One escaped and, she adds rather embarrassed, I think I broke the other one. I don't need you to put yourself at risk getting me another visitor, but we're dying to know how those little buttons work. If you can tell me that much, then this Hermietta stall is yours. Nobody gets them like we do. And if you fuck me over, she says as she sashays over to the closet door, pulling it open, the punishment will be very, very severe. A corpse in the shape and fashion of a mystery agent stares back at them through its shades. The individual is either unknown to Corey / Chaffer, or rotted to the point of being unrecognizable. Bile scuttles up Corey's throat as he scrutinizes the corpse that's rotting in the closet. A mixture of hatred and anger churn in his stomach. Wiping his brow and swallowing his ire, Corey says, One condition. Hermietta must be present when I show you the workings of this button. Is that clear?
Crystal, Cassandra says.
The pearly white door is open behind her. Is all well, my dear? Asks Javier. An antique silver cocktail shaker hangs loosely in his left hand. Oh my, Cassandra. I'm positively jealous. And Mr. Corey, I'd hope to find you enjoying yourself a little more. As it stands, you seem a bit peaked. Let's hope you haven't caught what's been going around. Casually, he strolls over to the closet door, quietly shutting it. Is that really something we should be sharing with our guests, my dear? Cassandra cackles. It's fine, Javier. Mr. Corey and I have made a little deal. We find this Hermietta stall for him, and he'll give us a demonstration of the device. We'll all play a game involving blindfolds and... Javier says, no, not another word. I can see where this is going. I want the rest to be a surprise, my dear, especially if blindfolds are involved. Woman, you're too goddamn good to me. They embrace, passionately necking and kissing, the force of Javier's urging pinning his wife to the wall with a loud thud. After a minute, she pushes him away. When he doesn't immediately give, she rears back and slaps him. Save it, Javi. We've got work to do. Is there anything else, Mr. Corey? No offense, but we'd like to get to work. I suspect this stall is a visitor, like the others. Her kind doesn't last long in a place like this. Javier wipes a small line of blood from his lip. Yes, time is of the essence, he says, composing himself. Nothing else, Mr. and Mrs. Domingo, says Corey. I shall take my leave so that I may secure my part of the bargain. How much time do you need to fulfill yours? Corey wipes his forehead with a pudgy hand and waits for their reply. Hours at the most, Javier says. Casually, he tosses the shaker from hand to hand. The hunt is already underway. I guess I should change, says Cassandra. Javier considers otherwise, but inevitably agrees with his wife. Show yourself out, Mr. Corey. We must lock this place up very tight before we make leave. Nothing will be left to chance from here on out. Do you think you can be ready in 2 hours? Taking any longer would spoil the mood. I plan on having a particularly long evening. We'll acquire her by midday. Or die trying, adds Cassandra from the bathroom. The couple share a laugh. I shall see you in 2 hours, says Corey, smiling unctuously. He waddles through the door and shows himself out of the manse. I need a shower, he says to himself, resisting the urge to retch. Chaffer divests himself of his corpulent alter ego and drifts through the streets, hoping to ferret out his compatriots as expeditiously as possible. He slips a Chesterfield between his lips and loiters underneath a cobwebbed awning to light it. He looks around at the pedestrians for anyone that he recognizes. The fucking Domingos are going to have their arses handed to them, he says through clenched teeth. A minute later, another agent treads by, keeping his head down. There is a slight shift in his step in passing, but he ultimately ignores Chaffer. It's difficult to tell whether he's avoiding his fellow agent or if he's simply unsurprised by him. Chaffer has ingrained knowledge of these people. He's a green tie,
and that means he's with Cursory Mnemonic Exploration. These CME operatives have their own duties to perform, something separate yet related to the duties of a mystery agent. Chaffer watches the agent sidle by and decides to let him pass. Growing impatient, Chaffer decides to apprehend his fellow agents. He decides to get a move on.
Thank God. I hate it when assholes stop me and ask a bunch of weird questions.
It's not like we don't have our own shit to do, the green tie mutters. As Chaffer vanishes around the corner, the green tie enters one of the nondescript, easily ignored buildings and is gone.
What's behind the door labeled private? The door leaf is white with peeled and dented paint on swaying double hinges, the clattering of dishes and humid steam emitting from within. Barker stops and glances around for a few moments, taking off his sunglasses as they steam up from the heat in the room. He moves in, sifting through the steam to look for somebody. Anybody. The noise but distinct lack of currently visible people is a bit more than unnerving. He notes the watch ticking and takes that as encouragement to press on. As Barker steps through the doorway, the room comes into focus. A small kitchen with a series of coffee machines, ovens, old-style ice boxes, not refrigerators, freshly stocked with ice, and a couple of servers moving in and out. At the far end of the room is a private table, slightly raised and dimly lit by candlelight. The round and freckled countenance of Hermietta Stahl greets Barker from the table. Barker steals himself and marches down towards her, brushing past the servers indiscriminately. "Stahl," he proclaims, intentionally addressing her attention. Provided the room's clear enough in the back, he puts his sunglasses back on, otherwise just leaves them off. He shows little or no sign of hesitation. The blindness was only momentary, ceasing the moment Barker crossed the threshold of the cafe back room. Hermietta Stahl smiles politely. "That's me. I don't think I've met you before," she says, gesturing for him to take a seat. Barker says nothing in reply. He reaches into his jacket and pulls some photos out of a manila folder and slaps them onto the table. He glares at her. "Got you." Hermietta glances at the files before shifting her gaze lazily back up to Barker. "They got me a long time ago, kid. You're late to the party. I'm already in jail. What else can you do?" Barker's previous lack of hesitation isn't so evident now. Thankfully, his shades are shielding his eyes, giving him some free showing of emotions as he thinks. "Already got her? Jail?" Barker removes his watch from his pocket and checks at what interval the hand is at as briefly as he can, trying to make sure he keeps an eye on Stahl. It's 5 in per the timepiece, clicking as it crosses the mark intensely, at each interval, like an expressive stopwatch doubling as a Geiger counter. Stahl's eyes are empty and distant, as if she can look right through him. "What are you supposed to represent?" she asks. Tucker enters the room and comes up from behind Barker and whispers something in his ear. "Agent, you are not cleared to be here. I am." Then he sits down. "Hermietta Stahl, I'm Agent Tucker. It is a pleasure to make your acquaintance." Tucker leans forward. "The reason that I say it's a pleasure is because that means I'm not a stranger anymore. You only kill strangers, right? Figure that makes me a fair bit safer. So tell me, Hermietta, what's your favorite flower?" Seals walks into the room, a hand instinctively slamming against his hip for a weapon the second he sees Stahl. All he manages to grab is a fold of his jacket. Seals notices a variety of potential weapons at hand. A paring knife, a long serrated bread knife, a coffee pot with an increased chance for area and collateral damage, a ladle of hot soup, also with an increased chance for area and collateral damage, a sterling serving tray, which may aid in deflecting attacks, a wine bottle, equally damaging whole or broken. Shield steps in the room, wincing slightly at the disjointed effect stepping through the doorway had on him. He quickly takes in the situation before him and moves up to flank Tucker and Barker, keeping a safe distance from the HP, and making sure not to make her feel closed in. Tucker whispers something in Shield's ear. "Agent, this is a deep blue zone. Are you cleared for this? You and Seals need to find the door back out." At this point, all agents recognize the hostile personality almost by instinct. The gaze she returns is abyssal and unseeing. Parker blinks a few times, looking shocked or confused. He glances to Seals and Shields, saying nothing. Pulls out the folder and looks through it again, seeing if he can read it this time. Unfortunately, only agents in possession of the reader technique are able to read text in Blue City. Parker remains unsure as to how he could have ever managed it. Memories remain clipped at this point of his awakening in the Domingo's basement. Tension hangs in the air, almost palpable, but if the watch is to be believed, it's only the mundane sort. Clearly unsure what to do, Seal shoves his hands in his pockets, though he does give another glance at the bread knife nearby. He looks around, not too eager to make eye contact with the HP at this moment, and leans over to whisper hurriedly to Tucker. What are we supposed to do now? Why haven't we attacked? Weren't we supposed to put a badge on her? Seals takes a deep breath and lets it out slowly, composing himself. He decides to stay quiet for the moment. Tucker shows no indication that he heard Seals' question, but instead glances meaningfully at Barker's watch device. Don't want to talk about flowers? That's okay, I didn't either. I have a new question, though. Why strangers? You don't look like a misanthrope. Maybe a coward, Tucker asks, trying to move the interrogation along. Barker makes an audible grunt in frustration. He puts the folder away briskly into his jacket and leans to Tucker. Watch reads at 5. I'll set up blocks on the exit, see what else I can stir up. Yell if you need me. And we need to talk later. Barker turns to Shields and Seals, pointing at them directly in turn. You two, come with me. We don't have clearance to see this. We have more work to do, he says, somewhat gruffly. There are still other objectives on this particular mission, he says, walking past them and expecting them to follow. We'll be contacted as we've fulfilled the necessary parameters for control to expose them to us. He adjusts his hat and opens the door to the cafe. Seals blinks as Barker walks past him. He opens his mouth as if to say something, but then decides against it and simply follows back into the cafe proper. Shields nods in response to Barker. I've got an idea where to start as well. Rather than pausing in the cafe, Shields heads straight for the door to the street. Barker nods as Shields leaves, turning to Seals. We'll have to secure any exits here. I'm going to follow Shields in a few minutes. None of us should be alone. Head around the back of the building and look for service exits. Bar them. Any questions? He steps outside, noting the dead squirrel, and crouches down to examine it. He takes off his sunglasses and looks into the little thing's empty, wide-open eyes. It looks kind of odd. The dead squirrel has abrasions and a small slick of red blood pooling about it. Without a proper autopsy, cause of death is difficult to determine. Circumstances indicate poison is a likely culprit. None that can be answered in the time we have, Seal says, smirking. He glances over his shoulder and mentally kicks himself for not grabbing that knife in the back room. Oh well, haven't needed them yet, and nobody else is getting them, he thinks to himself. He goes around to the back of the building to investigate for exits.
Shields steps out into the streets and thinks for a minute.
From what we know, this HP was a pharmacist. It might be a cold trail, but I'm thinking that we might need to head to the pharmacy and ask some questions. I think the HP will have left something there. Whether it's physical or information, I don't know. But I think it's a good place to start. Even better, I think I know the way.
In the distance, the building is hazy and indistinct. As the agent approaches, it gains dimension, details rising out of the blur, as if the whole thing were emerging from unknowable depths onto the surface of Blue City. Goosebumps rise on the agent's skin as one approaches the periphery, again antiquated in the typical Blue City fashion. Advertisements on metal signs shill for various medications and health products. Though an agent would only match these to the packaging and mascots of a particular product with little or no hint to its use. Inside, a long counter stands in front of the soda fountain, helmed by a young man in a folded white cap. An older man in a familiar white lab coat stands freakishly taller behind a tall counter, surrounded by shelves of medicine on both sides. As the door pushes open to let the agent in, a bell is rung by an attached pull string. Agent Shields enters the pharmacy and looks around. Spotting the man in the white lab coat, he approaches him cautiously.
Excuse me, sir. I was wondering if I could ask you a few questions. I'm researching an article for the paper, and I was wondering what you could tell me about Hermietta Stahl. I believe she was employed here at one point, and I would appreciate anything you could tell me.
Stahl, The woman from the cafe backroom, Shields was sure of it. But why had Tucker rushed them out like that? If they didn't have access, why should he? What was going on between him and the hostile personality? No matter. Shields was at the pharmacy already, and in a topsy-turvy place like this, anything he learned about the HP might be relevant. The pharmacist peers down from his high precipice, eyebrow arched. Stahl works for the hospital, chump. She only comes here to buy needles and testing kits. Anything I can get for you? Shields says,
needles and testing kits for what? And do you know anything else about her? How about her address? I got an old address, but the landlady said she hasn't been there in years. She said something about problems with her boyfriend, but didn't seem to know much.
The pharmacist says, nope, no address that I know of. No boyfriends either. Though she was sweet on Johnny over there. The pharmacist points to the bored-looking soda jerk behind the long counter. I think I know why you're looking for her, friend. And I can't say I'm much obliged to help. She might run that kind of business, but I'm an honest man, not some pill pusher. You'd do well to steer clear of those types, unless you plan on crossing the authorities, that is. Shields says,
thank you for your time, sir, and I assure you I will do nothing to cross the authorities.
Shields gives the man his best professional smile and heads over to the soda counter.
Hey there, Johnny. Heard you might be a man who can help me out. I'm looking for information on a girl named Hermietta Stahl. I'm looking for whatever you can remember about her, and I need it fast. Word is that she's causing trouble in town, and I think you might know what kind, so spill it, kid.
Mister, I don't much like your tone. Unless you're here for a cream soda, you'd best be on your way, Johnny says, pointing to the door. An entire shelf full of bottles and vials tilts forward and empties animatedly behind the tall pharmacist. The man starts, but he does not turn around, choosing to ignore it for the moment, watching Shields warily. Shields says,
listen, son, I'm sorry if I seem a bit intense, but the fact is that I'm trying to help you. Hermietta likes you, which means that it's only a matter of time before you become a target. Heck, you might already be one. Has she given you anything recently? Maybe something to eat or drink? Or even some medicine? Whatever you think, she needs help. And me and my friends, maybe the only ones who will try. Please help us help her.
Giving the soda jerk his best authoritarian stare. I'd never take anything like that, even from her, Johnny says. We know what's going on here at the pharmacy. The tall pharmacist clears his throat. Johnny looks over at him. What, do you think he's dumb? Damn visitors see it better than we do, he says. The pharmacist shakes his head, looking away. Shields says,
you're right, I don't see it better, but I can help you. I'm trying to help the city out. Right now, I need information. Hermietta's into something bad, but me and my friends can save her. It's not something you can do, only us, but we need something to go on in order to do it. We can help both her and you, but we need help to do it, because you see it better than we do.
Shields knows he is pushing his luck, but something seems right about this track. He feels like the walls of the world were transparent, like glass, for just a second, as if he could see through to the way things work. Something had shifted in his favor, if only for a moment. Johnny puts his hat in his hands. Said she was going to the botanical gardens. Asked me to come with her, but I've got to work tonight. Another accusing look is thrown the pharmacist's way, but the pharmacist is crouched behind the counter. Bottles and broken glass can be heard moving around a hard tile floor. There's also a faint sound from back there, something Shields can't quite place.
Thank you. Can you give me directions to the botanical garden? I'll at least let her know that you wanted to come but couldn't. I think that I also might be able to help her out if I go there.
Shields knows that the information is important. He has to get back to share it with the others before they leave, and he has to track them down, but he hopes to get just a little more out of Johnny. But Johnny says nothing.
Thanks anyway, Johnny. I think I can manage to find it on my own. We'll do our best by her, don't you worry.
Shields quickly leaves the pharmacy and heads back to the cafe. The pharmacist pops up from behind the counter. I thought he'd never leave, he says, wiping sweat from his brow. Greetings, junior agents. Don Fathom here. I wanted to start this off by saying something cool. Then I got all conscientious, and I was like, do people even say cool anymore? I looked up some modern slang, and according to parents.com, kids these days are saying things like dope and sick, which really confuses me since I thought those phrases were already kind of choogy decades ago. Creative work often means sorting through a lot of uncool, cringe stuff before you land on something that really slaps. Irving Goffman pointed out that performance is so inherent to human nature that even suicide notes tend to go through a few rough drafts. Quite sad, don't you think? I have to wonder if there'd be less of those if we humans weren't so critical of one another. This podcast is based on the Lacuna series of games by Jared Sorensen. We started this back in 2010 on something called Role Play Online, which can be found at rpol.net. That's rpol.net. If you're not familiar with play-by-post games or role-playing games in general, this is kind of an online forum where, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, players take on the roles of individual characters in a collective story. Usually someone else takes on the role of the world around them, as well as many of the individuals with whom they interact. It's kind of like Dungeons & Dragons as an interactive novel, except we're more like Noir Cities and Dream Monsters, or Bureaucracy and Misinformation. Trademark pending. It was my decision to keep as much of the original writing from Lacuna Slow Burn as possible. Of all the writing exercises I've done, Slow Burn was the best. Even this early in the game, I can see each of us improving bit by bit. It's interesting to watch as all of us as writers improve over time. Similarly, I made this podcast to improve my podcasting and get into voice work. I thought it would bring my friends along to keep me from getting too bored or discouraged. It worked. One of the most important lessons I've learned from all this is that the only way to get better is to practice, regardless of how you perform when you're just getting started. And as always, I'm thankful for you, the listener, for your interest in our little project. Hopefully you'll find a shadowy agency of your own one day. Unless they find you first. Before that happens, you can join us on Patreon to support this and other projects as we continue to expand our influence over the unsuspecting masses. You'll get access to all my classified materials and a bunch of stuff I made up, because let's be honest, they're all the same thing, really. Discover things the public just isn't ready to know. Experience the thrill of fictionally endangering yourself on a daily basis. Remain in a constant state of paranoia with none of the calories. Get bonuses, exclusive materials, early releases, and live broadcasts. All this and more at patreon.com/DonFathom. That's DonFathom. We're on social stuff too. Check it all out. We're Midnight Police on YouTube, TikTok, and X. We also have a Facebook group with the same name. We're on Threads too, though we're not really sure what it does yet. On Instagram, we are the Midnight Police. That is the Midnight Police. Get it right. You've been warned. This week's episode was written by me, Don Fathom, Matt Kimmel, Ian Bloom, and entities working under the pseudonyms Agent Chaffer, aka Older Cloud, Agent Seals, and Agent Shields. Today's episode was read by Don Fathom, Matt Kimmel, and Other Don. Production, editing, music, sound effects, pretty much everything else was by me, Don Fathom. I also remix a few public domain songs in these episodes, which sooner or later will hopefully make it into the show notes. All content from Lacuna Part 1, Second Attempt, is copyrighted by Memento Mori Theatrics. All rights reserved and whatnot. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 license. Quick review, agents. That means you can copy and distribute Lacuna Slow Burn under the following conditions. Refrain from changing or using it for commercial purposes and give us appropriate credit. Otherwise, we'll send the Spider-Man after you. Or something even worse. Lawyers. That concludes this week's episode, Junior Agents. But this isn't over. It's never over.